Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Deep Blue, and back for a second week in a row is BYU's athletic director, Tom Holmoe. If you haven't heard part one, go back and listen to it. We covered Tom's time as athletic director at BYU, playing football for the Cougars. Lots to talk about still. So, Tom, welcome back for part two.
Good to be back.
Since I have been hosting this show, you are the first person to get part two. So there you go. That's, you can put that feather in your cap.
Thank you.
I know you've accomplished a lot. I hope that's high on the list. So he's not saying anything. That means it doesn't mean anything. It's fine. Before we dive back into life as a football player, the entire country wants to know where the beginning of the Halloween costume tradition started. Where did this start? Because this has become not just a thing, but a big thing around Halloween.
That's funny. I'll be known as the AD that dressed up at Halloween. I think that's fun. Look, when I was a kid, my mom made fantastic personalized costumes. Nothing out of the bag. No, you didn't go down to the drugstore and buy a mask. It was, she made great costumes. So I love Halloween. I like that. And when our kids were little, I'd make sure my wife did it her best to get them in the good costumes. So fast forward to BYU, and when our women's soccer team does a really good job of dressing up in theme. So they always have a theme every year, or multiple themes. And one day, the day before Halloween, they asked me, Tom, what are you going to be for Halloween tomorrow? I said, oh, you know, I haven't really thought of it yet. And they're like, oh, boy. So I go home and I ask my kids, what should I be for Halloween? The soccer girls want me to dress up. So they kind of pull Justin Bieber out of a hat. So they give me this little crazy hairdo and a crummy little T-shirt and chains. And I show up and they go, Tom, who are you? What are you supposed to be? I said, Justin Bieber. No, that is the weakest Halloween outfit I've ever seen. And so I said, okay, game's on. I'll be better next year.
You were challenged.
I got challenged, and so then I just took it from there.
There we go. Well, it's certainly become an annual thing where now you're debuting it, not just on social media, but on BYU Sports Nation. It's turned into a big thing. And I know people love it. And how the detail, and you're in makeup for some of these for like 4 or 5 hours.
Look, it's no. I mean, I maybe go 3 hours is a long time in makeup, but it's fun. I think it brings a lot of chatter and conversation, and I can't tell you how many people I've met. Like, people will come up to me in the airport or I'm in a restaurant and they'll come up to me and I'm like, okay, they're going to talk BYU football or something, or 49ers, and they'll come up and go, hey, I have one question, and now I know what it's going to be. What are you going to be for Halloween? It's kind of amazing to me that it's come to this. But I mean, one of the things that's been great is it's been able to have me have the opportunity to meet so many people that like this little tradition we have.
Yeah.
And they're enthused about it. And people want to take their picture during the day. Like, how can you not like that? It's gotten a little bit crazy, and there's a little pressure now to outdo the year before, but it's fun. And it goes back. To every year, I make sure I go to soccer and go, girls, here we go. Yeah. I'm not Justin Bieber anymore.
All right. So now that we've hit the Halloween costume question, let's go back to on the field. Your time at BYU, there was a lot of winning going on at BYU, so I know that was fun. At what point did you realize, you know, this is something I might be able to do beyond just college?
I really never thought about it until my senior year. We actually had all these kids that were getting drafted. You know, Mark Wilson was a couple years older than me, and he was a first round pick of the Raiders. You know, and then I saw Jimmy get drafted by the Bears. And what first hit me, Jason, was when I had a great defensive backfield coach named Dick Felt. And Coach Felt had played at BYU. He was from Lehigh. And then he played in the old AFL and then transitioned into the NFL. He played for the Boston Patriots. And he played on a couple other teams, but he was an all-pro, and he was a great player. And when he recruited me, and he wanted to make me a safety, and he said, I'll make you a safety, but we're going to start you at corner so that you can learn man-to-man coverage. And while I was with him for those 5 years, he taught me kind of tricks of the trade. And I used to go, we'd have film at 2. I'd get up there at about 1 or 20 to 2 every day. I'd sprint up there and just see if I could have some one-on-one film sessions with him. And he would show me some things that I could do that were like not BYU football 2.0. And it was not just what he was teaching the DBs, but things that were a little bit more advanced. And he, out on the field, he'd try to help me pick those things up. And so I was super blessed to have some skill and a great team, but somebody that had an interest in teaching me some of the tricks of the trade that I was able to teach some of the guys down the road myself.
Well, while you're in school and you're playing, you're studying zoology. So at what point did your mind switch from not going to be a zoologist, but this thing could really happen for me in the NFL?
Probably my senior year. So anyway, Coach Felt, one of those days, it was my senior year, really early in the year, and he said, you know, Tom, I was just talking to a couple scouts today, and if you keep playing like you have been, you're going to get drafted. And I almost fainted and fell out of my chair. I literally hadn't really thought of myself as being a guy that would get drafted. I'd seen other guys, but I didn't think so. I mean, I always wanted to be an NFL player, but no one had ever talked to me about it. They didn't have all these ratings and everything like they have to this day. And so when he told me that if I had a good year, I'd get drafted, that's when my zoology grade started to drop.
Oh, okay. So the NFL draft certainly has changed over the years to become the spectacle that it is these days. What was your draft experience like?
Well, I had a knee injury early in my senior year. I tore some cartilage in my knee, and back in those days, you couldn't just go in and do a scope and be out, you know, 14 days or something like that. You were out for a long time. And so the team doctors at the time, physicians said, look, if you can hang in there, I think we'll be able to get through the year and we can do a scope at the end of the season before the draft. And so I hung in there best I could, but my knee was sore. It hurt. I sometimes would practice once or twice a week, about the last 3 or 4 weeks. So after the season ended, I got invited to play in the Hula Bowl in Hawaii. I wasn't going to miss that one. And then the Senior Bowl in Alabama. And so I went to Hawaii to play in that game, and there's some big-time players in that game. And I wanted to play against those guys and with them. And I came up to make a play, and my knee just – it felt like it exploded. And it was way more than what the cartilage had been. So I went inside, taped it up, and came out and played the second half. That's how we did it back in the day.
Yeah.
And so I got on the plane in Hawaii, flew to L.A., and then flew to Alabama. And when I landed in Alabama, I couldn't take my jeans off because my knee was so swollen. So they put me right back on the plane back to Utah. I went to the doctor, and they did surgery. And they said, you know what? Your cartilage was a mess. We cleaned it up. We took some out. We repaired some. But your ACL was intact. And then so I started to train, and it was hard. It hurt like crazy. So, you know, January, February, March, I trained and trained and trained to get ready, but it still hurt like crazy. So I went to the combine, and at the combine, there back in those days, there were 4 different combines, not just one. And each one of the doctors that saw me said, hey, you don't have an ACL. They didn't have MRIs back then, or at least we didn't at that time. But they do the stress test, and my knee was like super loose. And so the 49ers weren't at the – I went to 3 of the 4 combines, and they were the one – they were at the 4th one that I didn't go to, and they drafted me. And when they did the physical for me, after they drafted me, they said, you don't have an ACL. I said, well, that's what everybody said, but I could run by then. So I ran in mini camp and started playing, and the rest – I played 7 years without an ACL.
Wow. What?
And I taped it from thigh till ankle for 5 years. And then my 6th year, I went to the team doctor and said, hey, look, I can't run anymore. I'm slowing. I can run, but I'm slowing down. How about you think we take the tape off? And he said, no, we can't do that. It's too dangerous. I said, I'll sign a waiver. My knee was fine by then. So my 6th year in the league, I didn't play. I played every game with no tape on a non-ACL knee. And it felt great. And I had a really good year. Seventh year, get into camp, my hamstring, my quad, and my calf on that left leg start popping and tearing. And the doc said, hey, your knee, your leg had taken care of your ACL for all that time. And it's just not, it's done. You're weak and you can't do it. And that was it. So that was the end of my career. I finished off that season. We won our back-to-back Super Bowl. Yeah. And I said, sayonara.
I'm going to end on a high note here. I'm going to go Costanza here and end on a high note. So you go, so when you're drafted to the 49ers, obviously you're going to the 49ers in their heyday. I mean, this would turn into be the dynasty of the 49ers with Joe Montana there. And you talk about some of the guys on defense. I know you're very, very close with Ronnie Lott, which I think is really cool that you still have a relationship with Ronnie in that. But your very first season, you go there, you're married. At that point, do you you have kids at the time?
Yeah,
you,
three kids.
So you have three kids. So what was that like navigating all that? You're going from college to the NFL, and you're dealing with the injury, and you're married, and you've got three kids.
It's just like, I didn't know any better. Let's go. You know, I married my wife before the summer of football of my senior year. So we went through that senior year together, and I was hurt, injured a little bit during that. Played all the games, but... And then we went through the draft, and in between that, I got drafted in the USFL before the NFL was the first USFL draft. And that was discouraging because I got drafted in the seventh round by the Boston Breakers. They called me up, said, Tom, this is, I can't remember who it was, of the Boston Breakers. We're so happy to have you. Picked you in the seventh round. I'm like, ooh, I thought maybe I was going to go a little higher. I never heard one more word from the Boston Breakers by phone or by email or by letter. Never heard another word.
Really?
Not one word. I think they drafted me and said, okay, maybe they found out about my
knee.
Maybe
they found out that you didn't have an ACL.
I don't know, but I never heard about them. So we'd gone through all that together, and I just think that this is kind of the start of my wife being such an incredible strength for me, is that we do things together. You see her at every game. It's wonderful to be married to a wife that considers, you know, going to a, I'm going to just say, a baseball game.
Yeah.
And she'll go to that, and that's date night.
Sure.
So let's go to Raising Cane's and baseball. That's date night.
Sounds good to me.
That's it.
So you get to the NFC Championship game your first year. The second year you win the Super Bowl, you beat the Miami Dolphins and at Stanford Stadium. And basically, I mean, that's you talk about winning. You continued your winning ways from college into the NFL. How did you handle the winning? What was that like for you? Because everyone's going to handle that differently.
Well, I just didn't think it was about me. I felt like when I was at BYU, we were really, really good.
Yeah.
And we had Jim, and we had some great players. When I got to the NFL, we had Joe, Ronnie, Jerry Rice, Roger Craig, Keenan Turner. We were loaded, and I was part of that. So I didn't really put myself out there like, hey, look what I did. I just always felt like, man, I'm part of something big, and I loved every part of it.
It's also this time where you do start feeling those promptings again from the Spirit. If memory serves, it was something that you kind of pushed off for a little bit. You weren't sure this was what you wanted to do at the time, but it just kept coming back to you. The Spirit kept talking to you. Take me through that and ultimately what led to the decision to join the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Well, I think that for one, you know, I told my wife before we got married, I was not a member. And when we got married, I said, look, I will go to church. And I had gone to church while we dated, and her mom and dad had, you know, said, hey, you guys should get married. You guys are in love, and you've dated for a year and a half, and you're going to get married. So when we got married, I had been attending church with her. And when we went to San Francisco, I just started attending. We had some great young married couples, and I was an active member. I was an active non-member, excuse me, of the church. This is a great part. Like, people would call me up and say, hey, can you come speak at Fireside? You know, they knew that I'd been to BYU. Mm-hmm. I played for the 49ers, and people knew I went to church. So they assumed I was a member of the church. So I spoke at, you know, dozens and dozens of firesides, and people thought I was a member of the church.
They had no idea.
They had no idea. You know, I took the Book of Mormon at BYU. I'd studied tons of books. I loved the writings of the prophets and current apostleship. And I was trying to intellectually understand the church. And that I got a little bit too far intellectual and didn't let the spiritual run. And so it was hard for me trying to balance, you know, playing. This is where it got a little bit tough. And just this, I never gave up. I was always there. I was always in attendance. I had a calling. I was a Weebelo leader. I mean, people, these little young kids depended on me to be their Weebelo leader. I was doing firesides. And, you know, it was one day I just woke up and, you know, this is 7 years after we were married. And I said, I had this thought and people would say, hey, I had this dream. It's like a dream kind of a thought. And I would go to the pearly gates after I passed and I'd say, the Savior would come and say, hey, you made it. Here you are. Let me ask you a question. I gave you everything. I gave you, I got you, made you get hurt so that you could come to BYU. I brought you to BYU. You married the most amazing woman and you have great children. You play with the 49ers. Everything's going well for you. What I put missionaries in your place, you know, I've put many people, home teachers. Why didn't you join the church? And the only answer I could come up with was, I was afraid of what others would think. I was afraid of what my family would think, and I thought about that for a long time. And then finally one day that thought came to mind. I said, what am I thinking? This is my decision. This is my salvation. This is individual. This is about me. And just like that. I mean, after 7 years, I was in a quandary. And then one day, I was ready to go. And I was baptized like 4 days later.
How did your family react to your decision?
You know, they were a little disappointed because of the traditions of our family, the Norwegians and the Finns and all that. But they understood that it's my decision. It's my agency to make that call. And they saw in me a change. Mm-hmm. They definitely saw in me. They saw my family, my children. They saw that we were accomplishing what we were trying to set out to do, and that my wife and the people that I were around and my children were all having peace and joy and happiness and love in our life.
Are you still the only member of your family who's a member of the church? Or
yes.
Have anybody else joined?
I've done a lot of temple work, so there's a lot of people up there that I've done the temple work for, but of the living members, yes.
What did that decision do for you as you look back on it now?
Well, I was happy, and I had peace in my life, but it was a different kind of peace. It was a peace that meant that there wasn't a lot of anxiety or difficulties, but the peace that only Christ can bring— and knowing and the hope and the faith that comes, it just changed my life in every way. It went from, like I said, being all in to where now I changed and I've committed to making promises and covenants that are for me and my family that it doesn't, and it's about my extended family going forward and looking backwards. And I just love the fact that there's a plan of salvation that I didn't really know about. And from that time in 1988 until now, each and every year, as I read the Book of Mormon and Pearl of Great Price and the Doctrine and Covenants and the Old Testament, the New Testament, and all the other things, as I pray and attend the temple and do service, all those things, it just pulls it all together and brings me a peace and a joy that, you know, I feel wonderful. I wake up every morning and have a great feeling of love in my heart. And that's why being at BYU is the greatest place in the world for me, because I get to have the best job in the world, and it's a job.
Yeah.
And I get to rub shoulders and be exposed and feel the Spirit and see the Spirit every day. Feel it and see it every day in the lives of our student-athletes, our coaches, employees, our fans, people around the world, the numbers, letters, things that I hear and see. It's just wonderful.
besides having those types of experiences that you certainly hold dear, I know that there are a lot of experiences on the field that you will hold dear as well, multiple Super Bowls with the 49ers. Can you explain what it's like at the end of the year to win a Super Bowl and to be the best team in the National Football League? Is there a way you can describe what that feels like?
I actually think fans look at it in a different way, because for me, it was joyful, super joyful. We had, as a team, you have these goals, but, you know, you get Super Bowl rings, you get playoff checks, you get these bonuses, you know, but I'm going to tell you right now, I don't wear rings very much at all. And the reason why is because, like, soon thereafter the game's over, you just realize that it's not about the rings and the money. It's about the dudes in the room.
Yeah.
And, like, to this day, I have really very close relationships with those guys. We have a text thread with 49 DBs through a period of that time of the Super Bowls, where we talk on the, you know, a little bit every week. And this is 40-some years later. It's pretty hard to believe that what happened then is still alive today. And so you ask me, what did it feel like? It just felt good to accomplish a goal. But I think nobody is living on those things. Right. It comes up when you ask,
yep.
But I don't think about that every day. But I do think about the teammates every day. I think of my coaches. I think about things I learn there every day. And that's what, you know, swells my heart. It's emotional for me. When I stepped into Allegiant Field, the last time I was at a Super Bowl was when I was coaching the Super Bowl in 94. And so I came in into the thing, and I wasn't prepared for it. It was like I didn't understand the hype.
Right.
It kind of made me nervous and anxious that they're playing a game, and this hype was crazy. I didn't feel that hype when we played and when I coached. It was calm and peaceful. And I love that contrast, that when you play, you're in it. You're in it, and all the other stuff doesn't matter. And I think that's why we were successful for that run of a lot of years. And I think sometimes in playoff games or big games, whether it's high school or little league or college or pro, the teams that really have it together are the teams that believe in each other, and there's no hype, and their hearts are knit together. And that was our motto with the 49ers for all those years was one heartbeat. And when I came in there and felt that, oh, man, it's emotional just thinking about it. It's just you're thinking, man, what I had with my teammates, it's super hard to replicate. And I've tried to replicate that with so many teams. I try to teach them and tell them and share it, but it takes a deep investment. And not a lot of people are willing to do that.
You had mentioned, you know, being a coach with the 49ers. Was coaching something that felt like a natural progression for you? How did that present itself to
you?
Oh,
yeah. I mean, I think that you're attracted to people and instances, experiences that you have had. So I had such great experiences with my coaches that it was always something I wanted to do. I went into zoology, that was a major. It's really biology, because I thought, you know what, I want to be a doctor. If I'm not an athlete, I'm going to be a doctor. And I didn't really want to be a doctor. I just thought that would be a challenging academic road. But when I finished my fifth year with the Niners, I thought, I'm not going to medical school. There's no way. I'm going to coach.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to be an athletic director. I thought that back
really?
In my fifth year.
Wow.
So I got accepted to Ohio State for their graduate program in athletic administration. And then Lavelle called me because Dick Felt had had a heart attack and said, hey, Tom, I need you to come coach the DBs while Coach Felt recovers. And, you know, that was my way of thanking Lavelle.
Yeah.
I can come back and help you out. So I passed on that AD and went into coaching. And with that turn, whoop, did that for 2 years. Then Coach Felt came back. I went to Stanford, back to the Niners, to Cal, and then my third tour of duty here at BYU.
All right, we're going to get into more of your relationship with Coach Edwards when we come back. Back with one more segment with BYU Athletic Director Tom Holmoe. This is the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio. Welcome back to the Deep Blue Podcast here on BYU Radio. Jason Shepherd with you, my guest, BYU Athletic Director Tom Holmoe. Been gracious enough to spend a lot of time with me, and I have to say I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and we got just a little bit more before the break. Tom, we were talking about Coach Edwards and how after your playing career was done, you were considering going down one road, but Coach Edwards called you and asked you to come and be part of the coaching staff at BYU. I don't want to ask you specifically about that. What I want to ask about, you have talked, and everybody that has had a relationship with Coach Edwards has talked about what he has meant to them. It wasn't about X's and O's, wasn't about certain games. It was how he made me feel in the relationship that I had with him. What was your relationship with him, and what does that mean to you still to this day?
Well, I'm going to tell you, Jason, it started when on my recruiting trip. So I come into his office, and I'd been recruited by some of the coaches. Terry Donahue at UCLA was one of my faves, but there were other guys that were pretty famous names at those times that had talked to me. And so here I am at sitting at his, you know, in front of his desk, and he says to me, Tom, you know, I think that if you come to BYU and you really you stay out of trouble and you bear down in your books and you do well in school, that you probably have a chance to play. Maybe you could start as by your third year. And I'm like, my third year? I didn't say it, but I was thinking it. Yeah. My third year? Do you know who you're talking to? You're telling me all these other coaches told me I have a chance to start as a freshman. And I kind of walked out of there a little bit miffed. Like he told me if maybe you can start as a third year guy.
Yeah.
And so as it turned out, I redshirted as a freshman. I played a lot of special teams as a redshirt freshman. And I got to play a little bit of defense that year. And then my third year, I started. He basically told me the truth. And so like during that recruitment period, there was a time, and this might have been have something to do with me choosing BYU, is I realized he was the only coach that really shot it to me straight and told me how it really was going to be. And I appreciate that. So now, like all those things that I learned from Lavelle, I tell kids this all the time. A lot of kids, they want to come start as freshmen. I say, let me sit down and tell you a story about a great man by the name of Lavelle Edwards. And I tell them a story about me. It wasn't like meant to be that I was going to start as a freshman.
Right.
But when I waited my chance, I got my chance. I was ready. I was healthy. I was prepared. And I made the most of it. And that's if all our kids would try to take that route, it would cause them a lot less stress in their life and worry. And, you know, some kids play as younger than that. But that's probably the way to do it. Back in the day, Lavelle set that up is you didn't have to come in and start as a freshman. You got to sit behind people and watch and learn and grow and develop mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. And then when your time came, you were ready. That's like what one of the things that I learned from Lavelle. After that, Jace, you know, I don't know anybody that didn't like Lavelle.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things is you get to see a lot of the BYU people. In my job as the AD, I travel around the country and I see a lot of the older guys over the last 20 years that rub shoulders with Lavelle. They were coaches, ADs, commissioners, all kinds of important people in the world of college and in pro sports. Nike, Phil Knight. The people away from BYU, they always say to me, do people at BYU understand what you had? And I say, yeah, they do. But I think it's interesting that those people realize the impact.
Yeah.
And they weren't even here.
Yeah. I obviously got to cover a lot of Lavelle, well, not a lot, but towards the end, I got to cover Lavelle as a member of the media. But, and I know I've told this story, I don't think I've told it on this podcast, but so at the time, I was working at, it was then 1320K Fan, and I was the morning show producer. And it just so happened that the day before I was going to get married, we had Lavelle in studio the day before. And so the hosts were giving me a hard time that I was getting married the next day. And it just so happened with Lavelle in there, they asked Lavelle, like, well, Lavelle, do you have any marriage advice for Jason? So I am lucky enough to be able to say that before I got married, I got wedding advice from Lavelle Edwards. And I think that's pretty cool.
That doesn't surprise me for one minute.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. So, and I think also now to bring this up to maybe people that maybe a generation that didn't know Lavelle like a lot of BYU fans did, and they see the reputation that Kalani has. You can ask any player. The number one thing, the first thing they will say when you ask about Kalani, it's how much they love him as a man and love him as a person. I think it's very similar in those two.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with BYU. I think a lot of it has to do with the core of who they are and how they were raised. Both of them have dramatically different upbringings, but there's core things in them that I see. But I feel like both of them have married incredible women. And Timberly is more quiet. She's a little bit more reserved, but super, super supportive and engaged in that family, of the Satake family, so much. And Kalani's at peace, you know, because of his home life. He has an incredible wife who is there a lot.
Yeah.
I see her. But you look at Lavelle, and one of the things that I think is important to mention in this episode is that we still have Patty.
Yep.
And she's a jewel. And there is no Lavelle without Patty. There is no Kalani without Timberly. Those are two things a lot of people don't see in this day and age with all the media. A lot of the wives now kind of stay behind because of the exposure is too hot.
Yeah, sometimes it's to be protective of everything behind the coaches.
They need to protect their families. Yeah. They need to protect their children. And Patty, at the time, she did that to a degree, but she was a little bit more available and open. She was in the media. She wrote articles.
Yeah.
But we have her right now, and I think that every single time I see her, it's just such an unbelievable moment for me to go give her a hug and just know that this is Lavelle and Patty. You didn't say Lavelle, it was Lavelle and Patty.
Right. You had, coaching opportunities at BYU. You mentioned Stanford, the 49ers. And then eventually you got the head coach at Cal. What did that opportunity mean to you at the time?
Well, at the time, I thought I was going to take over the world. I thought, hey, look here, I've played for Lavelle Edwards, who's the greatest relationship coach in the history, and Bill Walsh, who's the greatest X's and O's coach. I could put that together, and I'm not going to lose a game. I might not lose a game. And one of the things that I learned, unfortunately, but I'm glad I learned it, but it was difficult going through it, was I wasn't myself. I wasn't Tom. There was Bill and Lavelle mixed into each other, and it didn't work. You couldn't combine those two. And I learned that everybody has to be themselves. You can learn, and but you have to incorporate that into who you are. There's certain things and certain ways, like Nick Saban is a great coach. I admire him. But I'm there's some things, if I had to coach again, I could pick out certain things that I'd put into my fabric, but it'd have to be on the fabric. I just had these two guys, and I did it like them, not like me.
Yeah.
And that was probably the biggest lesson I learned. It was hard. I was young, and I got beat up by a bunch of good coaches and teams in the Pac-10 at that day. And it was a tough lesson, but a good one that changed my trajectory after that.
Okay, so to kind of bring this back full circle, so we started in episode one talking about you being at BYU and then ultimately becoming the athletic director. When your time at Cal came to an end, was it always going to be coming back to BYU, or how did that opportunity present itself?
Well, you'll appreciate how this story ends. So I am released from my contract at Cal, and one of the first calls I get is from Lavelle Edwards. And he says, hey, I've tried to get you back here a couple times. You've tried to come back a couple times. Let's make it work right now. I think we can find a job. There's a job that might be coming available in fundraising athletics. You're the right person for it. Let's make it finally happen. And there again, Lavelle's in my life. He wasn't working here. He wasn't coaching.
Yeah.
But he had some influence.
Yeah.
And he said, let's make this happen. And I'm glad they did.
All right, so I would be remiss if we did this entire podcast, this two-parter, and didn't talk about one of the biggest things that has ever happened to this university and this athletic program, and that's going into the Big 12. Can you, and maybe it's going to take time, and maybe one day you're going to write a book about everything that happened. Can you explain what the time was like going from where BYU was in the Mountain West to an independent to ultimately into the Big 12? I know that's a lot of time to cover. What was that like to oversee BYU through that many significant changes?
Well, look, I think there were hills and valleys. We had some great wins and some championships with some great players, All-Americans and Hall of Fame coaches. We had some tough games. We had some tough seasons. We had some tough stretches. But it was up and down. But I don't think it was like that. I think it was rocky and bumpy with some peaks and some valleys. And that's pretty much how life is. And so I tried to keep a perspective of, let's just stay on the road. It's going to get rough. It's going to get bumpy. Our fans were very supportive. For the most part, I'd say the large majority of our fans are always there. Cougar Nation, super supportive. There's a few on the outskirts, and we need them to a degree, that kind of keep you honest by criticizing or being critical or questioning what you do, what teams do, what coaches do. Why'd you call that play? Why didn't you recruit this kid? You know, why'd you go for it on fourth down? And that's how it was in athletics. There's so many things that are going on, but day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year. That's how I tried to maneuver through it, because I couldn't say we're going to get into the Pac-10. We're going to get into the Pac-12. We tried. I knew the history, and I knew the current way it was going. And so when it came, we took a long time to go independent. It wasn't an overnight thought. But with President Samuelson and the other leadership on campus at that time, and we made a decision to do that with the not the Big 12, but a P5 conference in mind. But it wasn't, we knew darn well it might not happen. There was always a chance that it might not happen. And I think that just Cougar Nation, that's why I feel strong, because we have such incredible power with Cougar Nation. And when I say Cougar Nation, that's players, coaches, administrators, fan base, alums, students, supporters, sponsors, donors, everybody, because they're always there.
Yeah.
There's never a time when they're not there. They're ubiquitous. They're always there, even when things are tough. And so the tough times were easier to get through than you would think. And then we'd catch another good break and things would be good. And I, like I said before, I always knew we're going to have great players. We're going to have great coaches. Let's just not mess it up. Let's just not mess it up. And that was my pressure. Don't mess it up. Keep them on the track. Keep everybody in the fit. The fit is so important at BYU for every single person, for you and me, for President Reese and Kalani Sitake, for every single student that's here. If you contribute, you graduate, or you don't, you go out, you're part of it. And it's hard for me, because I live it every day, to express it, because some people look at me like, what are you talking about? Most people understand exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. And I love that. It's like Big 12, it came. I'm super grateful that it came. And I can't say I knew it would, but there were a lot of things that had to happen in order for that to come to pass. And when it did, I was just, whew.
Do you believe whenever you decide that you're done being the athletic director at BYU, and there's people start to look back on your time here at BYU, what do you want your legacy to be? And do you think, with the enormity of going into the Big 12, do you think that will be your legacy?
You know, I'm not really concerned about my legacy. I think other people are going to determine that anyway. And like, I can't wish it upon them or hope that it is. I think the way I've tried to get through day to day is, I've said this many times, so you may have heard it, but I live 7 minutes from campus. When I wake up in the morning, every single morning, I get in my car, I'm driving to work, I see Lavelle Edwards Stadium as I come off my road, and I see the temple behind that the next. And I think, oh my gosh, I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be working here. And I think, I feel good. I have not had a day in 19 years where I've woke up and said, this is going to be a tough day. I don't think I can do it. It's like, here we go. This is going to be a great day. What is coming our way at BYU today? Now, at the end of the day, it's still 7 minutes. So there's been some tough, it's taken me a half an hour to get home sometimes because it's such a rough, rough day.
Yeah.
But then the night comes and the morning comes and the next morning it's right back to let's go. And I think that's the mentality. If there's a legacy, I'd say he just stuck to the road. And there's a pathway that we should travel. And we stayed on the road. We didn't try to do things that are not BYU. I've had a ton of support. My team, the presidents, the administration, the board of directors. BYU Athletics is in darn good hands. Not because of me. It's because of Cougar Nation and all the support that's here. And so we just have to be able to stay on the road and then hit those bright spots. You're not going to top off every day. It's difficult. But those are the difficult, the bumpy road and the lower valleys. They're what create the high roads. And we've been on some high roads. And, man, I'll never forget those high roads.
Well, speaking of great days, today has been a great day. Tom, for you to be willing to spend this much time, I know you are an extremely busy man. I cannot thank you enough for being willing to do this, and I enjoyed this immensely. Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure. Go Cougs.
Go Cougs indeed. Thanks once again to my guest, Tom Holmo. My name is Jason Shepherd. Josh Bergstrom and Ben Hall produced this episode. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.